This evening, whenever you're listening to this program, welcome to the program. Got an email right before the show. Are you still taking the Tushin X cough syrup? Yep. Show enough am. A couple things I want to talk about tonight. First of all, what did you think of the beer summit today? Another issue. Although it's hard to focus on this overseas stuff right now, given the hell that's happening in this country. But Iran, today's events during that memorial service for Neda Aga Sultan, the woman, young woman who was gunned down in the original round of demonstrations, that memorial service erupted into more violent demonstrations. Monday's going to be the day that all hell is going to break loose. Monday. Because that's the day that Ahmadinejad has his inauguration for another term. And that's the day that the people of Iran are going to realize that all their protesting has been for naught. And as much as I hate to say this, I really do believe that Iran is going to erupt on Monday. I hope it doesn't. I honestly hope it doesn't. But we'll see. And the other thing that you know, like I said, I've been kind of laying low while I deal with this, whatever the hell it is, this virus or this bacterial infection, I don't know. Laying low and watching way too much television. And I'm becoming really, really, really aware how right-wing Republican conservative racism has finally exploded out into the open. And the right-wing talkers on radio and television can't hide it anymore. They can't use the code words that they've been using for the past 25 years that right-wingers have been eating media alive. And in fact, they can no longer consign this racism to the subtext of what they're talking about, so that white people hear stuff. And then it sinks in maybe 15 or 20 minutes later. Now, one thing about the racists like Beck and Limbaugh and Michelle Malkin and the rest of them, one thing that never fails to amaze me is that they think black folks don't understand what's being said when it's spoken in code. And I've said this on this program before and pissed off people for saying it, but I'll say it again. Black folk understand white people to a degree that white people will never understand black people. Never. 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 And there's a very simple reason for that. It's not that white people are stupider than black people. It's simply that black people have been observing whites in this country for three centuries. And white people never pay a damn bit of attention to black folk, not on the level that blacks have paid attention to whites. For example, it's not white people who have been going into black families to care for their babies and take care of their old people. It's not white people have gone into black families' homes and done the cleaning and the cooking and the nursing and so on and so forth. It's just the reverse. Now, I'm not going to belabor the point because I've talked about this before. But if you're white, don't ever think for a second. Don't ever think for a second, because you're fooling yourself if you think this, that black folk don't understand you and understand what you're going to do and how you're going to react to every single situation that would come up where blacks and whites have to interact. Now, if you think otherwise, you're making a fool out of yourself. This is just something that white people should accept, because blacks have been tending to us whites for over three centuries in this country. So, it's not that blacks are smarter than whites or whites are smarter than blacks. It's just that black folk have been observing and paying very close attention. And there's a reason that they've had to do that. First of all, their lives depended on it. Black folk in this country who didn't pay attention to every single nuance of white behavior might get lynched, might get stoned, might get shot at night by night riders. There's not a black family in America who hasn't at some point had to sit down with their black children, especially their sons, and say, now listen, I've got to tell you a few things. And then the conversation is about how to conduct yourself around white people, especially around white authority. Now that's just a given. I don't care if you agree or disagree. If you disagree, you're a fool. If you agree, then you have a level of awareness that, I'm referring to whites right now, you have a level of awareness that most white people don't have. If you're black and you're listening to this, you're going, mm-hmm, of course, you know this. So I'm not talking to black people right now, I'm talking to whites. All right. So when some fool, some goddamn moron like Glenn Beck, or some out-of-control racist like Rush Limbaugh, or some psychopath like Michelle Malkin, when these people start talking their race now, their race talk, they're not holding anything back. And the reason is, all of a sudden, there's a black president. There's a black attorney general. A Latino woman just got nominated and will be confirmed to the Supreme Court. White people who harbor this racism, who have been harboring this racism for a long time, are freaking out because all the subtle messages, all the subtext, all the warnings to their fellow whites over the years, apparently to these people didn't work. Because what? All of a sudden we have a Negro president? Are you kidding me? How did that happen? God damn, that can't be. And a black attorney general? Ah, eek. So this and these convulsions are starting to be more out in the open. It's no longer necessary for whites who are in positions of power, especially media power. It's no longer necessary for them to talk in the code, to wink and nudge and talk about, yeah, I believe in brotherhood. Mm-hmm. When in fact, that's a goddamn lie. And there's not a black person in America who doesn't understand that. See, this is a part that really gets me. The only people white people have been fooling are other white people. You know, black folks understand this. So here we are. So all of a sudden, we have a black this and a black that. And these are all positions of power. And the racists are sitting around going, and by racists, I mean the majority of white people in this country. They're sitting around going, wait a minute. How did this happen? How did we get a black president? Whoa. What? And the fact that we do have a black president and we do have African Americans in positions of power in this country now means one thing, that they failed. These white people failed in keeping blacks down. So now what are they going to do? Now it's going to be a frontal assault. There's no more holding this stuff back. There's no more pretending or being cute or being coy, white folks doing that. There's no reason for it anymore. Now it's a full frontal assault. I'm waiting for Glenn Beck to use the N-word on his filthy program. I'm waiting for the pig man to lose it completely and use the N-word. You know it's going to happen. So what they are doing, this is a classic, I mean, Jesus God, this is a classic example of projection. They are projecting their racism out on Barack Obama. They are calling him a racist. They are referring to him as somebody who doesn't like white people. And they're encouraging their listeners to give free rein to this racism. This is some toxic stuff, y'all. And the reason it is so deeply toxic is because it is the one intransigent problem in this country. The one problem will never be solved. This is like the Israelis and the Palestinians over there. Over here, we got the whites and the blacks. This is a problem that will never be solved. Never. Because it is so ingrained. So, the media racists, the Republicans, the right-wingers, the so-called conservatives, they are pumping this out into the public dialogue now like poison. And it's coming relentlessly. I'm going to give you a couple examples when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. The hour. So what we're dealing with here in the dear old United States of America, on top of everything else, is this unzipped racism now that is really starting to flood us. It's starting to saturate us. It's starting to get down to a cellular level, and the right wing. Sons of bitches who are so prevalent in media are the ones who are pushing this. White folks in their private lives have always harbored their secret racism. And there was a way of talking when you were around them that you thought would kind of, or we thought would kind of cover it up. And they, could see through that like a gauze curtain. I mean, like, come on. But now that things have changed so radically, there's no longer any need to talk about it quietly. There's no longer any need to talk about it in code. Now, when I say need, white folk also have been very cautious in how they talk because they didn't want the stereotypical black man to come up to them and smack them across the mouth if they use the N-word or whatever. So there's been this kind of I don't know how to put it, kind of a double speak going on. Saying one thing, meaning another. And the white members of Congress and the white political leaders and the white millionaires and the white business, the white power structure. How's that for an old term? They have always known about their own racism. But they've always been so secure. But now that security is starting to show some holes in it. I mean, Jesus God, we've got a black president. Uh-oh. So it's coming out. I want you to listen to something. This is an audio montage from the Rachel Maddow show yesterday. First is Glenn Beck, and then Limbaugh the Pig Man, and then Michelle Malkin, and then Limbaugh, and then Beck, and then Limbaugh. I want you to hear this. Listen to this.
This president, I think, has exposed himself as a guy over and over and over again who has a deep-seated hatred for white people or the white culture.
Here you have a black president trying to destroy a white policeman. I think he's genuinely revved up about race. You know me. I think he is genuinely angry in his heart and has been his whole life.
I think he is a racial opportunist.
I had a dream. I had a dream that I was a slave building a sphinx in a desert that looked like Obama.
He has a problem. He has a... This guy is, I believe, a racist.
And after that, they're going to go after Oreos. Might have to put that off till Obama's out of office, but they'll eventually go after Oreos.
Listen to that. Now, for you white folk who don't understand what an Oreo is, very simply, it's someone who's black on the outside and white on the inside. It's an old term that goes back a long, long time, and white people have no claim on that term. That's a black person's term. But the pig man, being the pig man, he will, he'll rip and steal anybody's terminology to make his point. But when you hear Glenn Beck, who just comes right out and says it, that he believes Barack Obama is a racist. And when you hear Limbaugh says he has a deep-seated hatred for white people, you goddamn freak, his mother was white. His mother was white. Now, I don't think Beck knows who his mother was. But Obama's mother was white. So you see how crazy these people have become. Now, here's the problem, as is true in so many of these instances where the neocon, right-wing, fascist, so-called Republican conservative punditry in this country that infest radio, when they and television, when they go after something, whether it is health care for everybody or an increase in minimum wage or unionization of the workforce or, you know, all those things that are just so key to having a decent life, they drag with them all of these people, most of whom are white, because most black folk don't even listen to this garbage. They really don't. I mean, why would a black person listen to Glenn Beck? There is no reason. So they've always, these white pundits have always dragged I mentioned this last night, this mass of 40 or 50 million white people who cannot think for themselves, never had original thought in their lives, and they just drag them this way, and drag them that way, and drag them this way. It's one thing to drag them into a negative mind frame about their own personal health care, which demonstrates the depth of the stupidity of these people, but it's something else again to start labeling the President of the United States a racist. It's something else again to start projecting their own fear and contempt and hatred for people out on the general public. Now, I've asked this a million times. I don't understand why these people are not removed from the airwaves. If I were king of America for one day, I would take every one of these sons of bitches off the air. I would take them out in a boat somewhere, find an island, and drop them off and say goodbye. Have fun. Eat each other. I don't care what you do. Goodbye. But, of course, I'm not king of America, never will be. We got a problem, folks. We have a real problem. Celebrate the next 100 years of engineering excellence at the GMC Summer Event. Check out the legendary 09 Sierra 1500 or the 8-passenger Acadia. Visit GMCDealer.com. Take delivery by July 31st. See dealer for details. It's 25 before the hour. I have a guy who listens to this program who is a tenor saxophonist with the Count Basie Orchestra. I guess I can say all that, right, Dr. Sax? And he goes by the name Dr. Sax. I've heard his music, and he is, he plays with the Count Basie Orchestra, for God's sake. The touring Count Basie Orchestra. And over the years, Dr. Sax has sent me a considerable number of emails, some of which I have time to answer and some of which I don't. Sometimes I've read what he's emailed into me on the air. And the one he sent tonight, right before the program, I want to share with you. I have to blank out some of the profanity, but Dr. Sachs writes, I always end up writing you, I guess because I feel like you understand. I'm watching this crap on television about how the Democrats want to kill off seniors. I'm watching blank with Tweety. That would be, what's his name? and saw the Ed Schultz program before. Maybe the Democrats set themselves up for this. Sounds like they did. But I'm just disgusted with the whole thing. And I just want to say, F it. I was feeling hopeful for a while, but they're sucking that out of me. I can't afford the crappy health care I have, and this battle about changing it is just getting ridiculous. Between the Professor Gates thing, the birthers, Glenn Beck calling Obama a racist, Republicans calling Sotomayor a racist, the teabaggers, etc., I'm just thinking these blanks are just too stupid to help, and ain't nothing going to change until they die off. These are some of the dumbest folks on the planet, and I know I've traveled the world, and people in other lands know more about our country than we do. And unlike what the idiots tell us, those foreign people live pretty nice, have health care and big buildings and cell phones and everything. I'll be goddamned. I didn't even mention that Boston cop, Officer Justin Barrett, who in a mass email called Professor Gates, quote, a jungle monkey, end quote. Anyway, brother, I don't feel like signing another petition, calling another congressman. I'm just tired of this blank. It's deep. It's deep. Dr. Sachs. And, yeah, I understand. And I had a friend here in Atlanta before he died, Hosea Williams, who was a civil rights activist. I got to know him because back in the day when I worked in direct media here in Atlanta, it was not difficult for a white journalist to get to know black civil rights leaders. And I marched with Hosea in Forsyth County, Georgia, back in the 80s, yada, yada, yada. But Hosea Williams used to tell me how, you know, he was a World War II veteran, how he fought in World War II. He got wounded. He was in a combat unit, infantry unit. He carried a weapon. He shot at the Nazis, and he got shot in return. And when he came back from almost dying as a combat veteran in World War II, when he disembarked in New York and tried to get back to Atlanta, he had to go through a whole series of events just to come home. Like when the train crossed out of D.C. into Virginia, Jose had to get himself up and go to the colored section of the train. When he got off the train in Atlanta, what he had to do, the only colored people were required to do. And you know, so on and so on and so on. And I used to listen to those stories that Hosea would tell and wonder how, you know, how do you survive that? I don't know. You go fight and almost die for a country that, upon your return, treats you like an, well, you know, a jungle monkey. Now, what Dr. Sachs is talking about, a Boston police officer who is also in the National Guard was suspended and his Army command taken away after admitting that he called Harvard University professor Henry Louis Gates a jungle monkey in an email. Justin Barrett is his name. He is 36, been on the police force 2 years, could be fired as early as this week, according to a spokeswoman for the Boston Police Department. The police commissioner there, Ed Davis, held a news conference today to denounce the language in Barrett's email, calling it, quote, venomous rhetoric and inflammatory. And the commissioner went on and said such behavior will not be tolerated. Well, the truth is, it can't be tolerated. For someone in law enforcement or somebody in the military, it can't be tolerated. I mean, if you're a pipe fitter or a chemist or a nuclear engineer, and you want to send emails to your friends about jungle monkeys and Negroes and make all your racist comments, okay, but you're not in a position of authority. Once you're in a position of authority, you had better drop that. You'd better stop that. If possible, realign your thinking. You're not going to realign your heart, but just realign your thinking until you get out of a position of authority, and then you can go back to being the racist chump that you started out. But when you're in a position of authority, You cannot. A white person cannot display that. That's the reason this guy's getting fired. Now, I would not be surprised if this becomes the racist topic du jour for Beck and Limbaugh and the rest of these pigs who will now jump on this one. Just like they jump on Barack Obama. They say Barack Obama is a racist. Can you believe that? The police commissioner in Boston said, I personally reached out to him to apologize for this offense. It doesn't say in here whether or not he did. But he refers to a man who has been arrested in his own house after showing identification, after the cop obviously lied in the police report. How come nobody's talking about that? I wonder if when they had their beer this afternoon, if Barack Obama leaned over and said, yo, let me ask you something. Why did you write in your police report that the complainant said two black men with backpacks were breaking into a house across the street when that was not what the woman said? I just got to ask you, why did you lie? But you see, Barack Obama is an accommodator. He doesn't want confrontation, at least not out where white people can see it. So I doubt if he said that. I damn sure would have. I wonder if Henry Louis Gates asked the white cop, hey, let me ask you something, officer. Why did you lie in your report? I'm just curious. So, apparently, according to this this ABC News report, tensions between the public and police in Massachusetts have risen since the arrest of Professor Gates. Many police officers continue to harbor resentments about Obama's remark. And civilians have derided cops as racist in basic encounters on city streets, according to Boston police officers. Resentments about Obama's remark that the Cambridge Police Department acted stupidly? What would you have called it? Did they act diplomatically? Did they act professionally? And I'm so goddamn sick of this riff that because a cop is standing there armed with all kinds of weapons to hurt you, tear gas and tasers and guns, all that stuff, that somehow when the son of a bitch obviously is in the wrong, that you're supposed to, and this applies to white people too, you're supposed to stand there and suck your thumb and say, yes, Mr. Officer, please don't tase me. Please don't gas me. Please don't shoot me. Yes, sir, you are absolutely right. I am just a fool. I am just going to stand here and dance for you because I know you are the man, even though what you are saying to me is total nonsense. Has no basis in reality at all. I do not want to hurt your poor, precious, goddamn trigger-happy ego, Mr. Policeman, because if I do, you may kill me. The least you will do is arrest me for your catch-all charge, disorderly conduct. But I'm not some street thug that you've just encountered after a drug deal went down. I am a respectable man, black or white, matters not. I am standing here on my front porch in my house showing you identification that clearly identifies me as living here, being who I say. And you are going to treat me like this? You see? People wonder why Henry Louis Gates got so pissed off. What would you do, Truth Seeker? And again, I don't care if you're black or white. What would you do? Well, if you were white, you would probably just kind of drop your head and just go, oh, okay, yes, sir, all right, well, you know, whatever. But you see, black folk have been doing that for three centuries, and maybe they just get a little bit tired of it. I don't know. What do you think? Anyway, we're going to take a break here. We'll come back. I got some more. I have more. Don't go away. Celebrate the next 100 years of engineering excellence at the GMC Summer Event. Check out the legendary 09 Sierra 1500 or the 8-passenger Acadia. Visit GMCDealer.com. Take delivery by July 31st. See dealer for details. Ten before the hour. Now this part of the story tonight, or at least what we're doing here in this first hour, is sort of stunning. A lawyer who moments earlier had been complaining to friends about police overreaction in the arrest of Henry Louis Gates, that lawyer got a taste of the Gates treatment himself. He's walking down the street with some friends. His name is Pepin Tuma, very, very white guy. You can go to Huffington Post, see his picture. 33 years old, walking with two friends along Washington's U Street corridor around midnight last Saturday, complaining to his friends about how Gates had been rousted from his house for not showing a proper amount of deference to a cop. Tuma said, quote, "We'd been talking about it all day. It seemed like it seems like police have a tendency to act overly aggressively when they're being pushed around," Tuma recalled saying. Then the group noticed five or six police cruisers surrounding two cars in an apparent traffic stop on the other side of the street. It seemed to Tuma that this was more cops than necessary. So Tuma said, "That's why I hate the police." He then chanted, "I hate the police, I hate the police." One of the officers strongly reacted to Tuma's little tune and shouted, "Hey, hey, who do you think you're talking to?" Tuma recalled the officer shouting as the cop came across the intersection to where Tuma was standing. The cop said, "Who do you think you are to think you can talk to a police officer like that?" Tuma said he responded by saying, "It's not illegal to say I hate the police. It's not illegal to express my opinion walking down the street." At that point, the cop pushed Tuma against an electric utility box and continuing to ask who he thought he was to talk to the police like that. Tuma said, "I didn't curse. I asked, am I being arrested? Why am I being arrested?" So the cop handcuffs this guy and took him to jail. He spent a few hours in a holding cell. He was released early Sunday morning after forfeiting $35 in a collateral bond to the police. He doesn't have a court date because a post and forfeit bond like that is not an admission of guilt. But an arrest will pop up now if an employer does a background check. So this lawyer, Tuma, filed a complaint with the D.C. Office of Police Complaints alleging a lack of probable cause, a false arrest, and that the officer used harassing and demeaning language. Tuma alleges that the officer called him, Tuma, a faggot. Tuma has retained a lawyer. He might sue if he's not satisfied after a meeting with the complaint office that occurred today. So, Tuma concluded by saying, quote, "People talk about the Gates thing in terms of race, but it's an ongoing form of police using disorderly conduct to shut people up." Yeah, it happens against white people, too. But white people's lives are not at stake when it happens to them. And that's the essential lesson the black folk have learned. Their lives are at stake. Their actual lives are at stake. And that's a hell of a difference from, if you're white, and a cop pisses you off and you let him know and you get hauled to jail and you get out and, you know, so on and so forth. But you're not going to be murdered on the way to jail. And then when the car arrives at the police precinct station, the cop jumps out and says, this guy tried to attack me. I had to shoot in self-defense, which has happened so many times with black people being arrested. You know it as well as I do. Now, I'm going to close out this discussion with a suggestion that you get a little book. It's only $2. It's called The Little Black Book, subtitled Black African Male Survival in America, or Staying Alive and Well in an Institutionally Racist Society. Now, the object of this is it's written like a survival manual to save the lives of black American males It was written by a woman who lives in Flatbush, Brooklyn, a black woman. She started out writing the rules for survival for her son. And she writes, I suddenly thought, why be selfish? Why not write out directions for all black males living in America? So it's called The Little Black Book. You can do a Google search on it. And it might be worth getting. It's not a new book. It was written in 1985. That's when she first wrote it, for the protection of her own son. Now, there's a new edition out, but it starts with a brief introduction containing advice from the Honorable Bruce Wright, who's an African-American judge, who has gotten the label controversial because of his open indictment of the criminal justice system as being biased against black people. So anyway, it's called The Little Black Book. I think white people ought to read it, but I think it's a survival manual for black children. And I think any responsible black mom or dad ought to get the book. Because not for any reason other than where we live. Come on. Come on. It's called The Little Black Book. And you can find it. Just do Google on it. Do whatever you need to do. It's $2. And if you buy in bulk, I think it's cheaper than that. It's small enough that it'll fit in your pocket when you leave the house. It contains all sorts of information that might be... can you believe we're talking about this in 2009 with a black president, black attorney general? Can you believe that Glenn Beck goes on national television and calls the President of the United States a racist? All right, we'll be back after the break. We have a moment with Bob this evening that you're going to love. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Individual results may vary.
Bottom of this hour, we're going to have a moment with Bob, so stick around for that. So what did you think of the beer summit? Wasn't that a hoot? A little bit of video. These four, was it four? Yeah, four, because Biden was there, and Gates, and the president, and the officer. The beer summit, or whatever it was. I think what happened, and I think, who was it that wrote it? Somebody at thenation.com online, or thenation.com. Brock had a moment last week when he decided to claim his blackness, and that's when he came to his friend Henry Louis Gates' defense. That's one way of looking at it. To me, what Obama was doing was stating the obvious, that the cops who did this acted stupidly. I mean, come on. Email from Kay in San Francisco writes, Hi, Mike. Thanks for the piece about farm-raised salmon. on last night's program, it was an important reminder for me to check the labels of the packages I buy, something I don't always do. I learned this lesson again last week when I bought some edamame from the local store. I got it home, ate a bit, and then turned over the package where I read soybeans, product of China. First, I freaked out, and then I got really angry. My dad was born and raised in Decatur, Illinois, the home of Staley's, the largest processor of soybeans in the nation, at least at that time. I visited Illinois many times and remember seeing hundreds, if not thousands, of soybean fields. Most of those beans were harvested and sent to Staley's, where they were made into all kinds of products. I can still remember how the smell from the factory permeated Decatur. And while it wasn't pleasant, it was a result of relatively safe domestic soybeans being processed. Obviously, we have had a pesticide problem in this country, too, but compared to China? Why is it necessary for the United States, whose Midwest is covered with acres and acres of soybeans and corn and wheat, to import soybeans from China? I guess it's just one more nail in the figurative coffin of the U.S. economy. And in the not-so-figurative coffins of people exposed to toxic chemicals in the American food supply, all brought to you by that wonderful concept called globalization. Yeah, I certainly agree with that. Oh, yeah, our military affairs correspondent, who lives here in Georgia, sent this to me. It says, authorities are investigating two Atlanta-area police officers from Decatur, Georgia, which is right down the road here. Two Atlanta-area police officers accused of using government computers to run a criminal background check on President Barack Obama. The public safety director for DeKalb County said yesterday that the officers had been put on leave until an investigation is finished. The officers' names were not released. What do you want to bet they're white? The public safety director says the police department was notified by the U.S. Secret Service that DeKalb County computers were used to run a check on Obama. He didn't say what the officer's motive may have been. You want to guess what the officer's motive may have been? Huh? My. And then this email is from Bob in Kentucky. I got to share some of these with you. I really do. People take the time to write, and it's not just for me to read. Bob in Kentucky writes, I always listen, but only write when something really pisses me off. So here we go. I moved from Indianapolis to South Central Kentucky for probably the same reasons you live in Georgia, away from the city, woods, nature, etc. But this area is not exactly a hotbed of progressive thinking. I work at a golf course here, one of the best in Kentucky, mostly because I enjoy playing golf and to pick up some extra money. The downside is that daily I have to listen to the ranting of the mostly rabid right-wing Republicans who come to play the course. I was watching a story on CNN this morning about the violence at the gravesite of Aneta Sultan in Iran and overheard some of the people in the clubhouse saying, "What's the big deal? I think they should kill them all." I also hear daily about how Obama wants to destroy the country with ideas for socialized medicine and all the other Limbaugh, Hannity, Fox News talking points that these people seem to parrot without the least bit of individual thought. I try to be tactful with my replies because I've decided that the two things a person does not discuss in this area is religion and politics. But at the end of the day, my anger level is off the chart. I wish I had a radio show myself that I could get all of the crap off my chest and at least for a while be less pissed off. But I do not have a show, and for my own mental health, I have about decided to say what I think to these people, regardless of any possible consequences. I'm about at my limit in dealing with the way these people think. Anyway, the weekend is coming up, and I'm going to go to Indianapolis to see my grandkids, which, by the way, are about the only reason that I don't expatriate to Montreal. Hope you could reply with some ideas on how you deal with these morons short of leaving the country. Bob in Kentucky. I don't know. I don't know how to deal with these morons. And trust me, having a radio show doesn't alleviate anything. As a matter of fact, it just brings it into sharper focus. But I would comment, when you say I'm about at my limit in dealing with the way these people think, a lot of folks feel that way. A lot of rational people in this country feel that way. They're all loudmouths. So if you notice the racists and the right-wingers and the Obama haters and the neo-Nazis, they're all loudmouths. They don't give a damn who hears them either. You know, they stick out that old chubby chin like, yeah, that's what I said. You don't like it? Alex Koppelman, writing at Salon, points out that the neocon right-wing crazies are now bringing abortion into the healthcare reform debate. Alex writes, there are a lot of ways for the right to attack healthcare reform plans currently being debated in Congress, but they're taking full advantage, and they're taking full advantage. The tack that might have the most upside for conservatives, especially for conservative groups looking to get a little fundraising boost in the process, is to hit reform by saying it will mean that taxpayers will have to fund abortions. That's what the Family Research Council is doing with a new ad that attacks Democratic health care proposals on two fronts, saying government will ration care and saying it'll use the money to pay for abortion. Let's listen to it. We got time. Yeah, go ahead and play it.
This president, I think, has exposed himself as a guy...
No, not that one. No, that's Glenn Beck. That's right.
They won't pay for my surgery. They won't pay for my surgery. What are we going to do?
But, honey, you can't live this way.
And to think that Planned Parenthood is included in the government-run health care plan and spending tax dollars on abortions. They won't pay for my surgery, but we're forced to pay for abortions.
Oh, my God.
Our greatest generation denied care. Our future generation denied life. Call your senator. Stop the government takeover of health care. Family Research Council action to be responsible for...
Future generations denied life? Son of a bitch. I live in an asylum, and so do you, Truth Seeker. They won't pay for my operation. What operation? What are you talking about?
They want me to pay for an abortion.
But they want me to pay for an abortion. Yeah, I hear you, Kathy. And they're going to come out every year, government agents, to old people and say, how do you want to die? And the thing that's just grinding to me, I've said this, what, 8 million times in this program? People out there believe this. Believe this garbage. They eat this garbage. They pray with this garbage. They have sex with this garbage. They bathe in this garbage. They stuff this garbage into their ears and their mouths and every body orifice they've got. No wonder they're nuts.
We're reaching a point where we can't turn back. Let's lose the guns and let's lose the bombs. Let's stop the corporate contributions that they'll build the pawn.
Well, I'll be sleeping on your stitches until I start to snore. Because I won't get a gun for an oil war. For salam, moving like a salam. Peace to the Middle East, peace to Islam.
Now don't get us wrong, cause we love America. But that's no reason to get hysterica. They're laying on the zero. We ain't waffles, we ain't having it.
In a world going on, it's hard to think right. So
he's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malone.
Past the hour. In addition to what Kay in San Francisco wrote about finding out that the product she bought, what is it, edamame? Had edamame? Do we ever eat that? What the hell is it? Soybeans? Well, why don't we just call them soybeans? Oh, those great big ones? I just don't remember eating edamame. We do eat it? Okay. You know, if it's beyond romaine lettuce, I get confused. Anyway, Prairie 2 writes, China has been buying every U.S. soybean they can get their hands on. And then they come back as processed food because they can make it cheaper. They can process it cheaper in China. You know, low wages, no food plant regulation for sanitation or worker safety. Is that a finger in my food? No restrictions on chemicals or additives and things we can't imagine. We are at war with transnational corporations that control U.S. agriculture and the food industry, and they are winning. Yeah, so in addition to getting products in a natural state from China, we also have the horror of getting stuff that was raised here and sent there to be processed. Does nobody in America know how to process soybeans anymore? Huh? You know what I'm saying. Yeah. Anyway, that piece of audio that we played for you of the Family Research Council saying that the health care proposals that are being debated, of course, they're attributing it all to Obama. They're blaming it all on Obama. What, 3, 4, 5 different congressional committees have been working on this. Each of them taking testimony, trying to formulate an idea. When it finally comes out for the president's signature, it's not going to be anything even remotely resembling what those of us on the progressive side of the political spectrum had hoped for. We'll see if it's an improvement, although it won't be single payer, and it probably will not be a very good idea at all. Because remember, Max Baucus, the Democrat that runs, the Finance Committee? One of the committees. And they had all that testimony about health care. Remember that several weeks ago? And every single person at the table represented a different part of the medical industrial complex. And nobody there to talk about single payer because, you know, like impeachment of the Bush crime family, single payer is off the table. Okay. Well, you know, we'll see how the government plan, or the congressional plan, I should call it, how it works, if it ever passes. But, you know, they call this government health care, government-run health care plan. And this is a part that drives me insane. Government-run health care plan will be available if you want it. But people who listen to Tony Perkins and the Family Research Council are so incredibly, monumentally, monstrously ignorant and stupid and brain dead and empty headed. I don't know what they think is going on with all this discussion about healthcare. In the first place, it'll never be, and it was never designed to be, a government run healthcare plan. It would be government financed healthcare. Option available. If you want it, in order to try to drive down your price on your private health care, you dumbasses. And that weaselly little male voice in that spot. If he is part, as the voiceover says, of the greatest generation, that means he's probably in his 70s or 80s, which means he's on Medicare, which means if he wants his goddamn operation, all he has to do is find a doctor who will order it and go do it. Play it again. Is that available? Can you play it again? There is so much bull hockey in this as to make it laughable, but there are people who will listen to this and just start their heads bobbing.
They won't pay for my surgery. What are we going to do?
But honey, you can't live this way.
And to think that Planned Parenthood is included in the government-run health care plan and spending tax dollars on abortions.
Yeah.
They won't pay for my surgery, but we're forced to pay for abortions.
Our greatest generation denied care.
Hear that?
Our future generation denied life.
Our greatest generation denied care. The greatest generation is people, you know, from the 20s and 30s and 40s that are still alive. And, of course, they're all on, they're already all on government-run health care. It's called Medicare. But the level of just crazed insanity and butt-level ignorance in this country is so monstrous, isn't it? And there's not a day that goes by that you can't see incident after incident after incident that proves that level of empty-headedness. That how have we managed to get through 232 years? How have we done that? I know. I'm just asking the question rhetorically. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, a moment with Bob. You're going to like this one. which is not to indicate that you don't like all of them, but, you know, stick around for this one. I'm Mike Malloy.
Full of children. Fighting communism. He'd seen the way they turned his dream around. I gotta go by what he told me. Try to tell the truth and stand your ground. Don't let the bastards get you down.
Before the hour on the Malloy Show and wherever you are too. Okay, let's cue up the music and enter into that magical, mystical world where we find another moment with Bob. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for A Moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Salmon Farming. The title of tonight's episode is, It's Not Our Fault, They Started It. And Bob writes, Hey Mike, the 1985 flesh-eating zombie flick Return of the Living Dead takes place at a medical supply warehouse in Louisville, Kentucky. Foreman Frank is training teenage Freddy for his new job. He tells Freddy that the film Night of the Living Dead was based on a true event. The military, testing a new nerve gas, had a leak, and corpses in the Army morgue returned to life. After the accident, one of the corpses, safely contained in a specially constructed capsule, was mistakenly shipped to their warehouse. Foreman Frank tells Freddy that it is down in their basement, and takes him down to show it to him. Since the movie's called Return of the Living Dead, it's only a matter of time before somebody gets loose from their container and more flesh-eating zombies show up. During an attack, Bert, the owner of the warehouse, drives a pickaxe through the skull of a zombie, but that doesn't stop it. Bert, I thought you said if we destroyed the brain, it'd die. Frank, well, it worked in the movie. Bert, well, it ain't working now, Frank. Freddy, you mean the movie lied? One of the best moments of the film is the anguished look on Freddy's face when he realizes that the movie lied. Now, the reason I'm telling you this, outside of the fact that I really like flesh-eating zombie movies, is when it comes to politics, current events in American history, I think we're a lot like Freddy. Now, I have to tell you another story. Years ago, a friend of mine asked me to videotape his sister's wedding. Took place in a Catholic church. He and I were up in the balcony, tape was rolling, and the congregation was lining up to receive the sacrament of Holy Communion. He whispered to me, "Watch this," and ran down and got in line. At that time, I had nothing to do with the Catholic religion for over 20 years, still don't, but my initial reaction when I saw him take communion was, "Mortal sin! He didn't go to confession first! Blasphemer!" For all you non-Catholics out there, mortal sin is a sin that, unless you confess it and receive absolution, you're condemned to hell for eternity after you die. And it's a super-duper mortal sin to receive the body of Jesus Christ if you've got a mortal sin on your soul. And I know for a fact my friend had a carload of unforgiven mortal sins. By the way, according to Catholic doctrine, the mortal sin of purposely missing Mass on Sunday is considered equal in gravity to intentional murder. And I've got at least 2,340 mortal sins on that count alone. The purposely missing Mass one, not the murder part. Even though I thought I got rid of all that gibberish Catholic voodoo, there I was up in the balcony thinking, mortal sin! After a few moments, the voice of damnation left my mind, and I wondered, where the hell did that come from? It came from indoctrination when I was 7 years old. That's when everybody in our second grade class had to memorize the Catholic Catechism to pass the test so we could receive the body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ. The scary nuns grilled us for weeks so we could take part in symbolic cannibalism. And all that gibberish was embedded in our skulls, and we were only 7 years old. I'm sure there are studies aplenty showing how indoctrination of the very young is the most efficient way to imprint whatever the hell it is you want to put into little psyches. And that was the primary job of the scary nuns, crank out more Catholics. But the gibberish didn't end there. By the time we got out of high school, we'd been studiously indoctrinated for 12 years into believing the myth of America. All of it lies. And those lies are what most Americans operate on for the rest of their lives, regardless of what our country does, right in front of our eyes. Sure, there's this vague idea that sometimes our country has done bad things, but most of the time we've been a force for good on the planet. Well, a few years back, I did a little egocentric-based research. Starting with my birthday, May in 1951, I tried to find out if our government ever told the truth about anything during my lifetime. And guess what? It didn't happen. Not once. If the government was, for example, your brother-in-law, and he had never once in over 50 years told the truth, wouldn't it be prudent to completely disregard anything he said? I mean, you couldn't even be skeptical at that point. Skepticism would have died years before. The truth is, he lies. The chance of his telling the truth is right around zero, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. But because of our indoctrination, when we see horrible examples of our government in action, we initially see them as aberrant incidents, not the norm. Sidney Shanberg wrote, quote, "We Americans are the ultimate innocents. We are forever desperate to believe that this time the government is telling us the truth," end quote. But when enough awful things start piling up, the familiar becomes normal. We become inured to the maimed and dead of the illegal wars started by our government, the wretched excesses of corporate America, the corruption that dictates the action of every sector, and this leads to a dissonance in the minds of anybody who's paying attention. Because a long time ago, people we trusted lied to us, and those lies were buried deep. The simple reality is that this country behaved like a beast until the Spanish-American War of 1898, and then we became an empire. And we've acted no less bestial than any other empire. Before we became an empire, we killed the Native Americans and everyone else within arm's reach who got in the way of America's destiny. For the next 111 years as an empire, we've killed anyone else around the globe who got in our way, year after year, decade after decade, regardless of who's in office, Republican or Democrat. We're not the good guys, and we never were. I have no idea what the solution is to make this dissonance go away. This is a perfect example of, even though I know what I know on an intellectual level, that doesn't mean diddly when I come across the latest horror perpetrated by America in the papers or on the internet. We've had decade upon decade upon decade of government and corporate crimes against humanity. And there I am in my chair thinking, you mean the movie lied? Yeah. And me and a hell of a lot of other people just can't get over that. It seems that receiving the typical American education instills a form of chronic subconscious naivete that holds precedence over facts. Where's the red pill when we need it? Regards, Bob. P.S. Would you be as surprised as I was when I realized The Matrix was released 10 years ago? Another Moment with Bob. Brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling and Offshore Aqua Farming. You know, talking about the horror of being convinced of you know, that cannibalism is a proper way to worship one's deity, which is what communion in the Catholic Church really is. When I learned communion in the Baptist Church, it was symbolic. But in the Catholic Church, it's literal. Well, regarding that, a central Wisconsin man charged with killing his daughter by praying instead of taking her to a doctor read from the Bible while testifying today that he couldn't seek medical help without disobeying God. Dale Newman told the jury, hearing his case, quote, "I can't do that because biblically I cannot find that is the way people are healed. If I go to the doctor, I'm putting the doctor before God. I'm not believing what he said he would do," end quote. Newman said that God promises in the Bible to heal. He is charged with second-degree reckless homicide in the death of his 11-year-old daughter, Madeline, from undiagnosed diabetes. Prosecutors said he should have taken the girl to a hospital because she couldn't walk, she couldn't talk, she couldn't eat, she couldn't speak. Instead, the 11-year-old died on the floor of the family's Weston, Wisconsin home as people surrounded her and prayed. Her father was the last person to testify in his trial. Closing arguments were scheduled for tomorrow morning. Mr. Newman, who once studied to be a Pentecostal minister, preached to the jury about his faith in God's healing power and cried out during his presentation like he was talking to the Lord. He said he's been a born-again Christian since 1982. He said the Holy Spirit once instructed him to burn two books in his library, and he did, which ended 10 years of back pain that a chiropractor had unsuccessfully treated. Newman said it was a spiritual cause of a physical ailment. He testified he thought Madeline had the flu or perhaps a fever, but he never expected her to die. He thought she was in a deep sleep, not unconscious. At one point, in his nearly 4 hours of testimony, Newman cried and nearly whispered to the jury, "Who am I to predict death when death is an appointed time for all of us?" Doctors testified that the little girl had a good chance of surviving if she would have gotten treatment.
But then one day, I met a man who came to me and said, "Heart will good." Oh, oh yeah.
Renegade Talk Radio done right. From the left, it's Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. The rest of this story from Wisconsin, the man charged with killing his daughter by praying instead of taking her to a doctor. Earlier today, a woman who had been at the death scene and prayed with the Newmans and helped give the 11-year-old a sponge bath a few hours before she died. She also testified she thought the girl had the flu. She told the jury, quote, "She looked a little pale. I could see she was weak. She would respond when we would call her name. She would make noises. She moved her head," end quote. This woman is a loyal member of the defendant's Bible study group, and she testified for the defense as the father, Dale Newman, his attorney, tried to show that father didn't know how ill his daughter was. The woman testifying said the five adults and three other children at the home gathered around the dying little girl, prayed, and took communion in an effort to heal the girl. The witness then went home and took a nap, expecting the Newmans to call her later and say Madeline was fine, walking again. The witness testified, "You see, I believe in the power of prayer." The girl died about 2 hours later. Someone called 911 when she stopped breathing. The mother of this little girl testified earlier that she noticed her daughter had been weaker and drank a lot of water about 2 weeks before she died. The mother was convicted of second-degree reckless homicide this spring and faces up to 25 years in prison when she's sentenced in October. Wow. Well, I mean, I have, I guess because I'm a parent, I just have a hard time dealing with the reality of parents who have an obviously sick child and do what they call praying as this child is dying. I mean, that really does. You may be against traditional or typical allopathic medicine. You may be, into natural healing and herbs and so on and so forth. Okay, that's cool. There's an awful lot of truth in herbal treatments. I firmly believe in some of that stuff. Just like I believe in a lot that is done in conventional medicine. I realize there's a trade-off. I really do. Having this cold, I get prescribed an antibiotic by my doctor, and I take a look at the contraindications and this and that, and I just put the damn thing aside and don't take it. You know, I just drink my Tussionex, which is probably worse, to try to not cough, and hope that my immune system is going to kick in and handle this. On the other hand, an obviously ill child, critically ill child, who's dying, and people take communion over her body. I wonder what the three children who were there, I wonder if they're spooked, didn't give their ages. This crime was committed a couple of years ago. It didn't give the ages of the kids who were there. I can remember going to prayer meetings with my grandparents. Very spooky. Very spooky. When you're a little kid and you see 10, 12 adults, as I used to see every, when was prayer? Prayer meeting was Wednesday nights in my grandmother's Baptist church. I didn't like it. I was about the only little kid that was taken to this. These are mostly older people, like my grandparents were, and they would meet in the upper room of the church. And it'd be hot and stuffy and smell like hymnals and furniture polish and be dust motes in the air. And I'd get up there and start to freak out a little bit when usually the preacher would lead off and the preacher would close the session. But the praying would get loud and fervent and desperate. A lot of these people would pray for a miracle about their husband at home dying of cancer, or their mother at home being, dying of TB or whatever. And of course, the people went ahead and died anyway. But as a little kid, I can remember sitting up there just kind of freaking out, just like, oh, my God, please get me out of here, quick. But if I knew if I was a good boy, when we did leave, we'd stop at the Dairy Queen on the way home and I'd get a nickel ice cream cone, which is about the size of a $3 ice cream cone now. But so it was, kind of worth the struggle. But I wonder what these three little kids who were present at this death scene as they watched this little girl die, I wonder if it burned something in their head that said, boy, you can't trust old God. Oh, God might decide to kill your kid. Hell, I'm a kid. What if he decides to kill me? Woo! I don't get that. I never have. But then again, I've already gone off on a riff about racism that people don't like to hear. I'm certainly not going to start another riff about the religious psychosis. The House today passed the so-called food safety bill. I got an email here from Captain Mary in Memphis, and I'll share it with you when we come back. I was vaguely aware that this bill was being debated and being worked on. I'm not sure of all the details that's in this bill. Sounds great, doesn't it? The food safety bill. But Mary apparently does know what's in this bill. And has written me an email here that I'll share with you when we come back. We're also going to open up the phone lines and invite your call if you'd like to check in. 877-996-2556. Let it ring. Kathy will get to you. And do stick around, all right? I'd like to hear from you tonight. I'm Mike Malloy. It's just about 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy program. And a little over a week, I'm going to be in Seattle along with Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Bill Press, Ron Reagan, and the former chief political writer. Was it chief political writer? Is that what? Yeah. For the Seattle Times, David Postman. We're all going to be there for the fourth annual Town Hall Forum that's put together by AM 1090 in Seattle. And I hope you're going to be there. It's a week from Saturday night. There are still tickets available. Best way to get them is go to AM 1090 Seattle, AM1090Seattle.com. And snag one. All right, this is a big event, and every time I've done it, see, I guess it's the fourth time or third time I've got fourth time that I've gone, and it's always a hoot, good time. So go to am1090seattle.com and get a ticket. Now, I said I would share with you an email from Captain Mary in Memphis, who sent me this a few minutes ago. And like I say, I have yet to really get into the so-called food safety bill. But I've usually found anything that's identified that way usually has nothing to do with safety, very little to do with food, and has an awful lot to do with the agribusinesses that that do this sort of thing now, that raise Frankenfoods and so on and so forth. Anyway, Captain Mary writes, I'm angry and grief-stricken. Today, the traitors in the House passed the so-called food safety bill. This bill attacks small organic farms and will bankrupt them. It imposes exorbitant annual registration fees, mandates extensive record keeping with expensive computers and software interoperable with those of big agriculture, forces farmers to submit to warrantless searches and to yield customer lists, and so on. It gives the FDA military police powers of quarantining areas, regardless of whether any contamination came from it, and stopping all customers buying from farmers markets. It makes farmers keep so-called pedigrees of their crops, meaning they'll have to buy seeds from one source. It'll be Monsanto, of course. The FDA can regulate how crops are grown and harvested and so on. And more House Democrats than Republicans voted for this monstrosity, which is a death threat against all Americans. I urge everyone to see the documentary film Food Incorporated, Food Inc. It contains all I found out about Monsanto, Tyson, big biotech, etc., taking full control of the food chain and thus of the population. These filthy industrial factory meat farms and genetically engineered crop fields should be burned to the ground. Simply put, food equal life. And now the bastard corporatists have control of it. We are so blanked. Captain Mary, irate in Memphis. Let me see. Like I say, I have not been paying that much attention, and probably should have been. It's being reported as the House approved today the first major changes to food safety laws in 70 years, giving sweeping new authority to the FDA to regulate the way food is grown, harvested, and processed. Well, that sends up red flags immediately, doesn't it? Is this the same Food and Drug Administration that just can't bring itself to declare cigarettes a addictive drug delivery system and ban them? Yeah, it's the same one. Now, the media is reporting this as the action follows a wave of food-borne illnesses over the past 3 years involving products as varied as spinach and cookie dough. Representative John Dingell, Democrat of Michigan, the bill's author, said, quote, Americans are dying because the Food and Drug Administration does not have authority to protect them, and American producers and agriculture are being hurt. This bill will fundamentally change the way in which we ensure the safety of our food supply. Well, I have to check it out because I have to plead ignorance on this one, the Food Safety Act. I'm sure there's something in there that alerted more than one something that alerted Captain Mary to this. Food safety bill, huh? That's like something called the Defend America Act, which really is all about destroying the Constitution, or the Coalition of the Willing, which, you know how language is eaten by these bastards. Janet is in Minneapolis. Janet, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
How are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
You're sounding a little better.
Oh, great.
Well, I was just listening, and, I listened. I was just telling Kathy I listen every night.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, I could not go to bed until I listened to you guys every night. And you're my life source. I mean, I listen to Air America, and, I'm a faithful since day one. And you are my source of life.
Oh, my God.
You keep all of us out here sane.
All right.
But I was listening to you, what you're talking about, the indoctrination, and I was thinking, I'm driving home and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. I was telling your wife, I said, I'm first generation Native American to be raised in the city.
Uh-huh.
And that's the first thing that my parents did was I was probably 3 years old. And my sister, 3 and 4 years old, my brother, 5. And the church came and picked us up every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started going to Sunday school when I was 3 years old. And I went all the way through grade school, junior high, all the way. And I'm like, yeah, you're absolutely right with this indoctrination.
No, they didn't teach you in Sunday school Native American traditions, did they?
Oh, heavens, no. No.
I'm just kidding.
And here's the thing, though, Mike. My dad is a very, very intelligent man. And after we got older, he told me, he goes, I wanted you to go there and I wanted you to learn about it. Because when you grow up and you are mature, I want you to make your own mind up what you think about it. And really, so he really did me a favor. I mean, I think he really did us a favor because we grew up learning it and knowing it, but I'm not indoctrinated. I've totally backed out. I'm, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I'm not a lamb. I'm not going to be led to slaughter. I'm a thinking person, and I think for myself and my family. I have a big family, and a lot of my family lives up north on the reservation, and I guarantee you they get emails from me every day.
I'll bet.
About everything. I read like 5 papers a day. I mean, I'm just like with Mary when you said that Monsanto.
Uh-huh.
Wasn't that, I think there was an article not too long ago, maybe a year ago or something, wasn't it? There's farmers like in Iraq or where Iran, wherever we went and destroyed Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And they were only allowed to buy seeds from Monsanto, and they only were allowed so many. And if they had any left over, they had to turn them back in.
Well, that's not just here, or that's not just in other countries, Janet. That's being perpetrated against American farmers, and it's horrifying. It's unbelievably horrifying. I don't know what the ultimate conclusion to all this is going to be, Janet. But it's not anything good. You know what I'm saying, Janet? I got to leave it there. Thanks. Glad you called in.
Because they
Celebrate the next 100 years of engineering excellence at the GMC Summer Event. Check out the legendary 09 Sierra 1500 or the 8-passenger Acadia. Visit GMCDealer.com. Take delivery by July 31st. See dealer for details. It's about 22 past the hour. Before we go back to your phones, quick missive here from our economic affairs correspondent, Prairie 2, who writes under the heading, "A Great Passbook Rate, If You Can Get It." Initial jobless claims are up again, but continuing claims are down, and this is reported as good news. But we are still losing jobs, so this means more of the benefits people are getting are running out, and nothing's being done about it. So expect a sharp increase in bankruptcies, foreclosures, and homelessness that will become more apparent with cold weather. A new trend that is really catching on is for cities to pay the homeless to get out of town. How many buses will Greyhound need to house all the homeless? It's starting to look like the early 30s when the empty train cars going in both directions would be full of men going to the next town to look for work. Corporate profits are up, but it's almost entirely from cost-cutting. Cost-cutting doesn't make money. Cost-cutting costs money. When the next quarter numbers come out in early October, the picture will be completely different. The big banks are showing huge profits, but not because they're lending more money. It's still impossible to get a loan. It's not because defaults from business loans are down. Write-downs are way up. They're not making money from foreclosing on more and more families. The big banks are making money by borrowing trillions from the Federal Reserve that the Federal Reserve prints and backs with thin air. The banks borrow at zero interest and then put it on deposit with the Fed at 6%. Does your passbook pay 6% or even 0.6%? The Fed has about $1 trillion of this money as reserves, but they're also buying U.S. Treasury bonds because nobody else will buy them at the current interest rate. Nobody knows how high interest rates would have to go before anyone would buy them. This is where the chills are supposed to run down your spine. Or if anybody would buy them. U.S. gross domestic product report comes out tomorrow. Don't expect any good news. Try to think of something funny to say. Prairie 2. Go to his website, prairie2.com, prairie2.com. Yeah, I hate when these numbers come out. It just, icy fingers, chills go up down my spine. Yeah. And in the middle of all this, it's interesting, this will be in tomorrow's New York Times, the last year of the Bush crime family's reign. Wall Street's Million Dollar Club had nearly 5,000 members. At least 4,793 bankers and traders were paid more than $1 million in bonuses last year, even as profits at these banks dwindled and they accepted tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer money. That's according to a report released today by the New York Attorney General's office. It'll be in tomorrow's New York Times or online. Wall Street bonuses have come under intense scrutiny from lawmakers and regulators who say they believe that freewheeling pay practices contributed to the financial crisis. The House of Representatives is scheduled to vote tomorrow on a compensation reform bill. Yada, yada, yada. But the figures released today by New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo provided the most detailed accounting yet of Wall Street's millionaire ranks. In the report, Mr. Cuomo said that 738 bankers and traders at Citigroup took home bonuses of $1 million or more in 2008, even as the bank posted a $27 billion loss. In all, Citigroup paid $5.33 billion in bonuses. It received $45 billion in bailout funds. Bank of America Merrill Lynch, whose merger brought the combined company to the brink of collapse, paid 868 employees bonuses worth at least $1 million. Both banks, whose compensation packages are being reviewed by the federal pay czar, turned to the government twice for bailouts, receiving a total of $45 billion in taxpayer money. And it just goes on and on. Morgan Stanley paid nearly 438 employees bonuses of at least $1 million. Including 290 who received more than $2 million. These are bonuses. J.P. Morgan Chase paid 1,626 employees bonuses of more than $1 million in 2008 and received $25 billion in federal assistance. I mean, it just goes on and on. Do you ever feel like, I guess I can't say that on the air, but do you ever feel like you're being horribly abused by the banking industry? And the Bush administration, this was their going out the door action. The TARP funds, almost $1 trillion, handed out to these filthy, corrupt, degenerate sons of bitches who eventually, and you know this as well as I do, eventually, they're going to feel the lash of the American public.
Not for me, not for you. It's a wonderful life. No stress, no strife. Never hurry, never worry like poor folk do. And oh, it must differ to be so wealthy, filthy, rich and young. One might wonder what great things they've done to become the fortunate ones. They're the happy members of the lucky sperm club. The only thing they have to do is be conceived.
Men, are you?
You're listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
It's about 25 before the hour. I've gotten a couple of emails here from people that can't find the Little Black Book, the one that I mentioned earlier. There's a website, African American Literature Book Club. African American Literature Book Club. And they have a website, AALBC.com. African American AA Literature L Book Club BC. African American Literature Book Club. AALBC.com. And if you go there, you will probably find it. AALBC.com. It's called The Little Black Book. And I mentioned it earlier. So check it out if you are so inclined. Back to your phone calls, I think. Was I in the middle of something? No. I wanted to get to that memo that is, it'll be written about in tomorrow's New York Times. Senior American military advisor in Baghdad has concluded it's time for us to bug out. Interesting reading. We'll get to it tomorrow night. Raymond is driving in Maryland, listening on Sirius. Hey, Raymond. No Raymond? Okay. Let me put you on hold, Raymond. Maybe it's our phones. We'll find out here quickly. Kirsten in Aberdeen, Washington. Hey, Kirsten.
Hi, Mike. At long last, I made it through.
Yes, you did.
Well, mainly what really got to me tonight, I'm getting your third hour with this phone call, but I'm on your first hour still out of Portland.
I hear you.
Yeah, and the opening of your program tonight, talking about race and racial issues and what you're picking up from the media, I'm so grateful for the work you do with racial issues and the lifting of consciousness, which needs to happen. My blowout came when I was 11 years old and homesick from school and accidentally got to see some beatings in Selma, Alabama. Police dogs, cops, the whole nine yards. And my mother in the other room coming in to try not to have me watch it.
Right, right.
And from that point on, I was never the same, Mike.
Yeah.
And I've stayed with the fire in the belly all these years, and it does not and will not ever go away where these issues are concerned.
Yeah.
So that became, for me in the 60s, a big part of what I was involved in, that and the Vietnam War. But it's been a real education. And we're, Jude and I are looking forward to you guys being out on the 8th in Seattle. We'll be there.
Yeah, now, you know, it's just I am coming. Kathy and Molly are not coming this trip. But all those other people, Michael Reagan and Stephanie and Hartman and Bill Press will all be there. So it'll be a hoot.
Well, we're pumped and we're happy about it. And I just, I told Kathy, you and she have brought Jude and I a lot of joy. And we love your passion. We love the cussing. We love all of it. And it's just great, Mike. You're who you are.
Well, that's
right. The program is what it is, and it means the world to us.
That's very kind. Thank you, Kirsten.
Okay, and you have a great night, both of you.
Okay, you too. Take care. Take care. You know, my epiphanous moment about race stuff, two events occurred when I was, I think I was a sophomore in high school, maybe a freshman, sophomore. The first was the murder of Emmett Till. And when I was a kid in high school, Alabama was, where'd it happen? Alabama, Mississippi? It was a million miles away. It was somewhere where I'd never been before, the Deep South. But I will never forget those pictures that were published in the Northern Press. His mother insisted that there be an open coffin at the viewing. And I'll never forget those pictures. I can see that picture of Emmett Till now, 50 years later. I can still see that picture in my head. So it must have had horrific influence on me, imprint. The second event occurred the next year when I was either sophomore or junior in high school. Now, I played football in high school, and the senior members, the boys on the football team who were seniors back in the day, got to elect the homecoming queen. It wasn't, you know, open voting for the student body. And I can remember our football team was about 60% white and about 40% black back in the day. And when the balloting was finished among the senior boys, high school players, a girl named Sharon Goldie was elected queen. And she was literally African-American in that, I think like Obama, she had one parent that was black, one parent was white, whatever. And Sharon was elected the queen. First time that that had ever happened at a Toledo, Ohio public school, ever. Now, the fact is, we on the football team, even though I didn't get to vote because I was a junior at the time, I think, we thought that was just great. Of course, you would have had to have seen a picture of Sharon to understand why we all thought that was great. But because she really was, and you know, these homecoming queens and stuff, you know, it's always based on what they look like. Come on. And the student body of our high school, I thought, was pretty pleased with all that, too. Well, the next day, very next day, we all came to school. And I walked across the campus, and there was a huge gathering, huge crowd of kids out in front of the school. We had a replica of the Liberty Bell in front of our school. It was cast in bronze or something. It was in like a stone well. And all the kids were gathered there. And I went up to see what was going on. And somebody said, "Oh, Jesus, you haven't heard?" And she pointed up in the trees. We had these huge elm trees and oak trees in front of the school. She pointed up, and there, way up in the upper branches, was an effigy of Sharon Goldie hanging. And I it took a minute for me to understand what this was. Well, after about 10 or 15 minutes after I got there, the principal and the dean of boys and the dean of girls, everybody came out. The administration came out, and they got some of the more brave boys together to climb up an extension ladder and cut this thing down. And there was this deathly silence among everybody who had gathered out there in front of the school, because we all considered ourselves to be, without knowing it, we considered ourselves to be liberals. We considered ourselves to be progressives. We didn't have those terms. We didn't apply those terms to ourselves. But, you know, this is a high school that was black and white, was Jew and Gentile, was gay and straight. And even all those years ago, I'm talking about back in the 50s now, we all just kind of got along. I mean, without making a big deal about it. There's even interracial dating that we all thought was just cool as hell because it really pissed off the adults. But anyway, we all trooped into the school. Everybody was quiet. Everybody's kind of stunned. And another incident I'll never forget, at the principal of the school came on. And he gave about a four-minute talk to the student body. And I think he was Jewish, about how horrific this event was to not just to the idea of race relations, but to the kids that went to the school. He also told us that three of the senior boys on the football team had fessed up. They thought it was a prank. They thought it was going to be funny, I guess. And I forget what happened to them. I forget, if they were had to do detention or expelled or whatever. But it was a real eye-opener. And rather than drive us white kids and black kids into our respective little shells, it opened us up even further so that we could talk about this. And, of course, Sharon was surrounded all day with white and black kids who were offering whatever support that we thought she needed. Of course, she didn't need any. She looked at it. She took the attitude anyway. I don't know what she was feeling in her heart. But she took the attitude that it was two or three misguided senior boys who thought they were having fun, who, in fact, really had done something that hurt her and hurt the student body. And, of course, it wound up in the newspapers the next day and yada, 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 yada. But those two events, to me, the murder of Emmett Till and seeing that picture, and I can see the picture of Emmett Till in the coffin more clearly than I can see the picture of all of us gathered on the high school campus with that effigy up in the trees. And there was something about the effigy up in the trees. It was November. In November in Ohio, in Toledo, Ohio, the leaves are pretty much gone. Trees are bare. Sky is kind of cloudy and dark. And this is back in the day when the industrial Midwest was the industrial Midwest, so there's a lot of crap and garbage in the air, so everything is kind of gray. That's just how Toledo was. And I remember just a chill in seeing that effigy hung up there, but the picture of Emmett Till. So those are the two incidences in my life that just got my attention, snapped me around like somebody had just hit me with a bullwhip. Celebrate the next 100 years of engineering excellence at the GMC Summer Event. Check out the legendary 09 Sierra 1500 or the 8-passenger Acadia. Visit GMCDealer.com. Take delivery by July 31st. See dealer for details. Tim before the hour. Thanks to our motley crew again tonight. Ben Birch, Sharon Gordy, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolfer-Zenberg, and the executive producer and engineer for this program, Kathy Bay. God, no screw-ups tonight. How did that happen? I didn't get any emails from people saying, can't hear the callers! And we didn't have any screeching feedback. And what else did we not have tonight? No power went out. No connections were broken. The Simeon worked. The commercials played. Oh, my God. We're jinxed. Raymond is driving in Maryland. Raymond, welcome to the program.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to make a comment about this horrible problem we have in this country with the police and what they put the black people through. And one thing that I was thinking about when I was at a shipper's office the other day, I noticed a sign about employee rights and how certain government agencies are still allowed to polygraph. And I wonder if the police, if these chiefs and whatnot, if they really cared about race relations, if they could, why they don't polygraph the, you know, potential cadets so they could wash those kind of people out of the programs.
Yeah, here's the problem as far as I see it, Raymond. If somebody wants to be a bigot, they're going to be a bigot, whether it comes as a choice, which it very seldom does. People are not born saturated with bigotry. Just look at little kids playing, whether they're Palestinians and Jews or black kids and white kids or atheists and Baptists. You know, kids are kids, and they play, and they have a good time. Bigotry and racism is a learned response. We're not born with it. And I think, you know, while I like the idea of trying to root this stuff out before it has a chance to do all this damage, I don't know that that would be possible. A. B, people have a right, if they choose to be a moron or a bigot or a jackass, you know, they have a right to do that. You know, these white cops, black cops, green cops can think anything they want to. It's when it's applied. It's when it's used as a rationale to taser somebody or murder somebody or handcuff somebody. That's the problem. And I honestly don't know how that could be, you know, how that could be discovered. You know what I'm saying, Raymond?
Well, I'm just thinking that those types of polygraph questions could be framed. I mean, if it's determined that there is someone who's that hate riddled with any type of minority group or women, that sort of thing, that those people could be washed out. Another thing that occurred to me is I wonder how many other blacks were abused by police within the same time frame that this professor was. Only this was brought to our attention, and the rest of the stuff is just under the rug because, you know, they weren't an important person like him. And I mean, I think that it's important that those kind of important people, they are brought to light because it represents what these police forces are all about. Not that every cop is a horrible cop, but I think that there's just way too many that have these kinds of ego problems and whatnot. And I really believe that a lot of those guys could be washed out if these departments really, really were concerned.
Right. Well, I take your point. I understand completely what you're saying, Raymond. Thank you. I guess my response is simply, I don't know how. Yeah, you could test somebody and see if there are strains of racism, but that would pretty much eliminate just about every white person in America, if you know what I'm talking about. If we're going to be honest about it, because maybe not every white person. Let's say yes, every white person over the age of 35, with a few exceptions, but the vast majority, the younger people seem to be. Younger white people seem to be getting over this. I don't know if they're getting over the racism or if they just see it as utter nonsense. You know, as the planet heats up and the planet shrinks and life is under all kinds of threats, it seems, I think, to younger people absolutely monstrously ludicrous to sit around and bitch because somebody's a Jew or somebody's a Palestinian or somebody is gay or somebody's black. You understand what I'm saying? Or somebody's white. It's illogical. It makes no sense. And, I mean, this is what I'm hoping. I have no idea if that's going on. I have no idea. But as far as eliminating people who have the potential to, use their position of authority and power to dominate somebody for no reason other than they have a position of authority and power. I don't know how you would do that. I really don't. But I certainly understand what you're saying. So, all right. tomorrow night, thank God it's Friday, right? Oh, my God. Ah, I'm so glad when this week is over. Not that I haven't enjoyed my 3 hours with you every night, but you know what I'm saying. So I'll see you tomorrow night. And in the meantime, don't drive drunk. All right, take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.
Attention.